I believe this is item number 9, right?
It is, yes. Good afternoon, okay. Chairman Noren and members of the board. My name is Catherine Carter, and I'm a member of your staff in the Watershed Adaptive Management Unit. I'm the supervisor for that unit. And today, the purpose of our item today is to share with the board and members of the public all the great work that has been conducted after last year's October 2017 wildfires to document water quality conditions and effects on our watershed. So today you're going to hear updates from a panel of presenters, whom I'll introduce shortly, who are going to provide you an overview of the work that has already been done and the work that everyone is planning for the future. And before we start, I did miss the last item, so I'm sure this was covered, but I wanted to remind us all that there are still many fires going on throughout our region and throughout the state, and that everyone at the North Coast Regional Board has those folks affected in our hearts and our thoughts. And additionally, our office has reached out to those affected to share the resources and things that we came up with dealing with last October's fires with them in a hope that that would make their response to their events easier. The impetus for today's item came from a 2017 Regional Water Board meeting where staff provided you a comprehensive review of all of the different efforts and activities that we had undertaken in response to last October's fires. The staff also presented some preliminary findings of our near-term post-fire water quality monitoring results for you. Although we didn't have all those results available, we were pleased that they didn't seem to show any impacts at that time. At the conclusion of the meeting, the board asked that we come back and kind of do an update for you and follow up when we had our final results. And so therefore, that's why we figured you'd be interested in hearing about not just our activities, but others' activities throughout these fires. And that's why our panels are here today. So we're going to be presenting to you in about 5 to 10 minute presentations, and we're going to start off with the first four presenters here, after which we'll take a break for board questions. Janice Oakley of the Division of Drinking Water has to rush away after her discussion, so we'll actually pause at that point for questions, but the rest of us can take them after all four presentations if that's okay with all of you. We'll then invite up the next set of four speakers, and I'll introduce them, and then we'll do questions again after that. And if there's time at the end, you're welcome. You know, we can all come back up for questions. And then before I start, I just want to note that the focus of today's discussion is going to be a lot of discussion surrounding what has been done after the Tubbs and Nuns fires that took place. But that's not to say there hasn't been a lot of really great work that was done in response to last year's Redwood Fire. For example, the Mendocino RCD has secured over $840,000 to do restoration projects and from state water board funds. And we're also expanding our monitoring, as I'll discuss in a little bit, to kind of encompass that area to document effects this coming winter. So I'll introduce today's panelists. There will be myself talking about the North Coast Board's findings. To my right is Kevin Lundy, who's a senior environmental scientist with the San Francisco Bay Regional Board, who's the head of the TMDL and Basin Planning Unit. Next to him is Janice Oakley, who's a senior sanitary engineer with the State Water Board's Division of Drinking Water, and her unit's responsibilities include covering the area of Sonoma County. And on the other side of the table is Heaven Moore, who's a supervising engineer with the City of Santa Rosa. As everyone may recall, the Tubbs and Nuns fires burnt over 90,000 acres in the Marquess Creek and Santa Rosa Creek watersheds, which amounts to 28.5% of the Laguna de Santa Rosa watershed in which they lie. Over 8,000 structures were destroyed in these fires, and this elevated the potential risk for pollutant-laden runoff to enter surface waters during storm events. So when Regional Water Board staff were preparing our post-fire monitoring plan, We made sure that we reviewed those monitoring plans that had been developed for fires in other areas of the state. We also reviewed literature sources so that we could determine which pollutants we'd be most likely to see as an outcome of urban and wildland fires. And what we determined from this effort was that the most immediate threats to assess were there any threats to public health or to aquatic life in those urban areas that were highly impacted by the fires. So therefore, we developed a monitoring plan that focused on these questions in defining water quality during storm events below the burned areas where they were highly urbanized. And we had two purposes that we wanted to cover with this monitoring. The first was to characterize water quality and to determine if human health and aquatic life water quality thresholds are being exceeded. And the second question was to determine if the best management practices that had been implemented were proving effective at keeping the pollutants on the landscape and out of the water. Our monitoring plan included sampling four sites on four occasions, and this included we did one pre-storm event, which we used as a sort of a baseline for conditions prior to the winter rains and runoff, and then we did three storm sample events. The sites are shown on this picture, and it's a little bit hard to see, so I will point them out to you, but the first site is on Upper Marquest Creek, and it was within the burned area of the Tubbs Fire, and above the highly urbanized areas that were burned during the fire. The next two sites were on Lower Marquest Creek and Piner Creek, and those were both below the burned areas and below the urbanized areas. And the final site is on Santa Rosa Creek, and it's downstream of wood capture effects from both the Tubbs and the Nuns Fire. But the main reason that it was utilized as a location was because we have a lot of historic data that we wanted to use to compare to the current data to see how current the conditions documented after the fire compared to those baseline conditions we had during prior storm events before the fires. Well done. So it's always, I do want to mention this picture, which is really hard to see. It's always very challenging to do this sort of storm sampling. The storms are never convenient. They generally started between 9 and 10 in the evening. So this is a picture taken by the Press Democrat of our swamp staff, Rich Fadness and Carrie Ann Lopez, who unfortunately is no longer with us, of them under a bridge at about 1 in the morning in Marquest Creek. So this is what sampling looks like when you're really dedicated to your job. And as I said, the reason that it was important to go out at these specific times was the idea was to capture the first storm flush coming off the landscape, as that first flush has the greatest potential to be carrying the highest levels of pollutants to surface waters. So the trigger that we use to determine which rainfall events to sample and which would be we'd be looking for which would cause erosion whereas any storm event that was predicted to have a 1 inch or greater rainfall within a 24-hour period. And we were successful in doing that, as this text shows, and it's a little hard to see, our rain events went from 1.21 inches in total to 1.95, with this one being in the middle at 1.36 inches. So we were successful in capturing storms that met that criteria. The charts show the different times of sampling. They show first the rainfall event, as you can see in green here, and all of these three storms were relatively low intensity. The third storm was a little higher intensity. The blue line, which it's hard to see, it's blue, shows stream flow over time, and the black dots show where on the hydrograph we sampled. The goal here would be to sample at the rising limb of the hydrograph where it starts going up, and this is too enthusiastic with the pointer. This shows a really great example of where we target it correctly, but again, when you're sampling in the middle of the night, I think we did pretty well under the circumstances. The samples that we collected were assessed for over 60 parameters, including metals, nutrients, and polynuclear aromatic hydrocarbons, also known as PAHs. And these are a class of compound that are generally found when organic matter, such as oil or gas, is burned. And the results of our investigation were documented in a fact sheet, the first page of which is kind of shown here, and I believe it was in your board packets. We sent this fact sheet out to an email list we have of persons who are interested in this topic. We put it on our website, and there are also copies on the table in the lobby in case anyone is interested in taking one with them today. Overall, the good news is that we found that water quality didn't pose any immediate threats to public health or to aquatic life. While we did detect some low-level concentrations of PAHs during the second and third storm events, and in the third storm event, we did detect aluminum in our samples at concentrations over the aquatic life criteria, all of our samples were also sent for aquatic toxicity testing, and all those toxicity tests came back negative. Additionally, all of our samples were compared to those baseline historic samples I mentioned that we had data from Santa Rosa Creek. And what we saw was that the pollutant levels we saw after the fires during storm events were consistent with the same levels that we saw pre-fire during storm events. So from these results, we concluded that the best management practices and that the debris removal activities that have been conducted prior to these winter storm events likely prevented these pollutants from entering the surface waters, as we didn't see any signal that would indicate fire pollutants entering surface water. I want to note that the sampling last summer was slightly confounded because we did have an extensive dry period and all of the storms sampled were relatively low magnitude, so we're not quite sure whether, you know, it took a while for the ground to saturate, and it was only in about the third storm that we saw evidence of sediment erosion occurring. So for that reason, we have interest to do monitoring again this year to see if, as we know, it's usually the second or third year after the storm where you can see these more elevated effects. So we do plan to do monitoring again this year. We've been fortunate enough to be granted funding for additional monitoring from the State Water Board, and we're currently in the process of trying to encumber those funds in a contract. The contracting process can take a bit of time, but we're confident that we have money in our surface water ambient monitoring program budget to cover any lapse in time that may occur while those are being encumbered. And our goal here also is to expand our monitoring to, we're hoping, 6 to 8 sites, including sites in the upper watershed that would capture what is going on after the Redwood fires and also the Mendocino Complex fires that are occurring this year. And we're going to also up there be focusing on what are the effects in the wildlands. We plan to try to target some larger storm events this year if we have them. That would be our goal. So we can really see what happens when the sediments mobilize off the landscape and if we see any changes. We plan to that end, we also plan to add, last year we did water toxicity. This year we're going to add sediment toxicity. So again, we can see if sediments entering surface waters, if there are pollutants bound to it that are causing any effects. And we will also monitor for the same chemical constituents that we did last year. We're going to continue our coordination again this year with our partners, many of whom are here today. And we're also thinking about the longer-term vision for this sort of work and thinking about a monitoring program for the Russian River that could carry monitoring and tracking of conditions into the future. And that's something that Chuck Striplin will be discussing in more detail at the end of today's presentation. And with that, I'll pass it to Kevin.
Right. So good morning, Chair Noren and members of the board. Again, my name is Kevin Lundy, and I'm a senior environmental scientist with the San Francisco Bay Water Board. And I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you guys today to share about our sampling efforts in Region 2 and to see if we can have any lessons learned to prepare for future fires or other natural disasters that may occur. So the Atlas, Nuns, and Tubbs fires burned over 80,000 acres in Sonoma and Napa Valleys and destroyed more than 1,300 structures in our region. Similar to your office, we were concerned about possible impacts to aquatic resources, such as our steelhead and Chinook fisheries, as well as general aquatic life in these rivers. We were also concerned about water quality impacts to drinking water reservoirs in Napa Valley. And shortly after the fires, our staff worked with our local nonprofit, as well as our local government entities, to implement stormwater control measures. And you can see the some of these measures here on the bottom right of the slide involved a bit of stormwater wattles, as well as gravel bags, to try and contain debris on burn sites and prevent it from entering the creeks. So the primary objective of our monitoring program was to try and see if these measurement efforts were effective in preventing this debris and pollutants from entering our creeks that has been observed in past fires. So to develop our monitoring program, we coordinated closely with your staff and also interacted with staff at the Southern California Coastal Water Resources Project, called SCORP, because of their past work on fire monitoring in Southern California. So we sampled in each watershed in Sonoma Valley and Napa Valley, we sampled four burned sites in each watershed, as well as an unburned reference site. And we used this approach because we did not have a lot of stormwater data within these areas, and so we wanted to get a control for what generally occurs during storm conditions. We also took the effort to sample a kind of temporal reference, just like Region 1 did, in sampling the creeks before the storms occurred. I'll mention that's a little challenge because not all these creeks were actually flowing before the rains occurred, but we did what we could with the conditions that were out there. We used a very similar analyte list to your staff here. We sampled for heavy metals, PAHs, as well as nutrients, as well as dissolved oxygen and pH. We were fortunate enough to work with State Board and get cleanup and abatement account funding to help support our monitoring, which was incredibly valuable because it cost over $35,000 to conduct our monitoring program. But we were able to start monitoring before we received those funds because we had a regional lab contract in place with a good analyte list and so and available funding. So our sampling program captured four storms ranging from just a little over an inch in magnitude to 2.5 inches. And nearly every analyte that we sampled out of 2,000 analytes was below the acute or chronic threshold. And this actually came as quite a surprise to us, a pleasant surprise. But we were really expecting to see more elevated compounds compared to work that's been done in Southern California. We did notice a small increase in our storm samples, but we noticed that in both our burned and unburned watersheds. So that was largely attributable to just the nature of general runoff occurring during storm events and not because of the fire-impacted areas. In comparing our data to Southern California, and I'll point out that some of our metal concentrations, like for zinc, for example, were over 100 times lower than in some of their large storm events. So we really did see a different signal here in this watershed, these watersheds, based on the fire intensity and rainfall patterns of this past winter. So we concluded that our stormwater BMPs were effective in preventing burn material from entering the creeks. And we used a fact sheet seen on the right here to reach out to our stakeholders and communicate with the public to share the news about our monitoring program as well as the results. So although we were pleased to not see significant problems from the sampling last winter, we do plan to do a little bit of work this year and see if there are any future effects from the past fires. So our goal is to sample one very large storm event, if nature complies, preferably about a 2 to 4 inch storm event, and that would be after the soils are very well saturated from normal rainfall conditions. We are fortunate enough to be able to use some existing swamp resources or our regional lab contract to support that sampling effort, and we'd like to coordinate with the North Coast Board to see if we can sample the same storms as we did in the past season. So I will say that, as you can see in the picture on the left here, sampling for storms is a challenge. Staff wake up essentially, well, start out at night, as Catherine said, work all through the night, get it back at the office at 5 a.m., you know, working in the dark and in the cold, and we really appreciate the effort of our swamp sampling team to go out to these two watersheds and capture this valuable stormwater data. Thank you.
Good afternoon, members of the board. My name is Janice Oakley. I work for the Division of Drinking Water. I've spoken to you a couple of times. My office is here in Santa Rosa. We oversee public water systems in Sonoma, Lake, Mendocino, Napa, Marin counties. My coworker is Sherry Miller, and I obtained some information from her for how Redwood Valley was affected by the Tubbs. No, I think it was a different fire up there. But during that time, the October wildfires. Okay. Here I am. Ooh. Josh, maybe you could lower the lights. Thanks. So here is the red is the outline of the Tubbs and the Nuns fire. Just to give you an idea of the number of public water systems that were affected. In the purple are the service areas of various water systems. Here we go. So the city of Santa Rosa is well known, Lark Field. There are also smaller water systems, Safari West, and I believe Pepperwood Preserve is going to be talking later on today up in the north. There are also small water systems, such as Journey's End Mobile Home Park was on its own well. Down in the Kenwood area, there are also mutual water companies such as Bennett Ridge Water, Mutual Water Company that was affected, and Valley of the Moon had water systems that were also affected. In total, there were 34 public water systems that were affected. Here I have another graph. Let me see. Now that I've asked for it to be dark. Okay, here we go. This is North Santa Rosa, just to show you how many water systems that were affected. So this is just that area that's north of Santa Rosa where we have Reebley, or here's Marquess Springs Road and Reebley. This water system, where is Marquess Acres, is along here, and your staff call it Linda Lane, just to kind of give you an idea. But there are a number of mutual water companies just in this North Santa Rosa area. They're all on wells, and we had to make sure that when they got back up to service that their water met drinking water standards. So as I mentioned, it was 35 public water systems that were affected, 33 are groundwater systems, and two of them are surface water systems. A partnership that Catherine noted, when the first rains were being forecasted, that Region 1 staff reached out to us with the fire intensity maps and the slopes and predicted debris flows so we could target the assistance that we gave to water systems that were in the predicted area of intense debris flow to make sure that they were ready for any contaminants that came their way. So I really appreciate the partnership that we've been able to build on with the Region 1 staff. This is a quick map of that, and our drinking water sources are these, of course, they're little orange dots, which not to be confused with the dark orange of the burn, but this is just a graphic to show that we were able to identify those water systems. So we had groundwater systems. We also had some watershed sampling that was done. Within the water systems, we also had tanks, and the distribution was also sampled. I guess going back to this, luckily or unluckily, those systems that were most at risk of the debris flows were also systems that were inactive at that time and are still inactive, such as the Camp Newman down on Petrified Forest Road. And then a couple of graphics just so you can see. This is a tank with Bennett Ridge water system where there's burn marks because of the heat, and that also that affected the coating on the inside. So we had to make sure that if the water that was in contact with that had gotten into the distribution system wasn't affecting the public. And this is also like a slight burn to a pipe at a wellhead. And for the most part, all of these facilities were replaced. Our findings for the groundwater, we had system sample for, initially it was nitrate and for bacteria. As we learned the effects, as we were getting results back from water systems, that we would have them also sample for volatile organic compounds and semi-volatile organic compounds. And we found no contamination to the groundwater. For the surface water, again, we didn't find any variability from what had been their results in the past. And the sampling at tanks and the distribution system, the only place that we found problems, so the distribution system are the pipes that go to people's homes. If a home had burned and had the water had sat in the line for an extended period of time, we did find detections. But in terms of the water boards, the regional board, wanting to know about the effects to the aquifer, we didn't see any. And I guess I have this huge pause because of the Fountain Grove with the city of Santa Rosa, that they had a number of instances where burned homes had had the service lines were affected, which is a whole another topic. But to the point of the aquifer, that we have seen no effects from the fire affecting the water quality. And I think that's all I had.
Okay. So given that Janice needs to step away, are there any questions for her at this time?
Janice, can I ask you a quick question?
Please.
I'm aware of a water system that's up in Mark West area that that a lot of their infrastructure was burned. And this isn't necessarily a water quality issue, but that their infrastructure now needs to be replaced, and including fire flows, where traditionally this system had not had sprinklered homes. I believe the requirement now will be to sprinkler these homes. How many of these systems out here then are going to be needed to be retrofit to sprinkler homes and have fire flow?
To my knowledge, they're all being required.
Yeah, so through this mutual system, then, the upgrade requirements are actually fairly steep, because fire flows are a whole different animal than is potable water flow.
Right. In a lot of those systems, they're having to upgrade the pipes to the homes.
That's right. Very interesting.
And a lot of those are volunteer boards that are also having to build their own homes in addition to rebuilding the water system.
And also, to be clear, all these water systems in this area in Santa Rosa are all groundwater-dependent water systems, right?
Correct.
We really don't have surface water besides the Russian River, the whole Sonoma County Water Agency aqueduct, and their contractors. And
correct.
All that, right? Okay. Great. Thank you. Oh, one last question for you. Will there be any different testing requirements per Title 22? Will the state actually require these systems to do an enhanced monitoring program and pursuant to Title 22 for fire-affected systems?
We're looking to do that, but from the lessons learned, we have broadcast that information to our partner districts, and they're following up with their systems, like with the Carr fire in the Redding area and the Southern California fire. So there's a lot of discussion that's going on within the Division of Drinking Water to enhance that post-fire monitoring.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming back.
Thank you.
All right. Good afternoon, members of the board. Thank you for having me. I'm Heaven Moore. I'm supervising engineer for Stormwater and Creeks for the City of Santa Rosa. And I just want to give you a little bit of context for Santa Rosa. I know we have good sense for the fire overall. So with the fires, we had, you know, 4.3 square miles impacted within the city. What that meant for my storm drain system is about 1,400 inlets within that impacted area, and 40.9 miles of storm drain system. So on about day three, after the initial fires started, we shifted our efforts and started to look at how to protect that system and how to deal with the potential for pollutants and debris moving into that system. When we first started, it was city staff and materials we could get as quickly as possible to get gravel bags and wattles placed in front of all of those inlets. That expanded into a really tremendous partnership that included a huge group of nonprofits, as well as coordination with the county, Army Corps, FEMA, Cal OES, and the regional board. So that really did turn into, I know the task force is going to be represented here shortly by Virginia, but just trying to recognize the amazing effort on the ground from almost day one. And kind of what that meant. Okay, so we did, for the sampling that we conducted, we did first flush monitoring and a BMP effectiveness study, and we really worked closely with regional board to do the same events, the same sampling events, so that we could have comparable data both in-stream and from the storm drain system. So these were grab samples, and we were pulling out of our system or out of the curb and gutter, depending on which focus was. Also, just in that really early response, some of the other things that we as a city took on, and in that, you know, early winter period, so cleaning of the storm drain system with the vac jet truck occurred, as well as street sweeping, and then the hydro mulching, which was really supported out of the regional board to help with those large hillside areas that were unstable, potentially unstable, along especially Cross Creek and in those areas where we're steep. So this first flush sampling, just touching on some of the same things you've heard. These were grab samples from five locations in Coffee Park. We have five outfalls, the system breaks that way, in five different directions as pipes go. And it was the same type of thing. We were out there popping lids into the evening and trying to catch that peak flow. And what we found from the results, we used the same constituent list that the regional board was using, with the exception of the aquatic toxicity, since we weren't sampling and receiving waters. And we found that our results were consistent, that we really weren't seeing anything atypical from historic levels. That first effort, just to give you a sense of scale, was about just over $17,000 worth of lab analytical costs, as well as our staff efforts. That was something that we had to support. And then to give you a sense, I know we've all seen these images, but it helps me when I go back to look at our results, what we were up against here. So we were dealing with lots of melted and metals and all sorts of debris. We had cars and all kinds of things. So this early response and this the results showing consistency with, you know, historic levels was a huge win, and I feel really, really great efforts got us to that point. So at that same, for that same sample event, we also did a BMP effectiveness study, and we had two kind of objectives there. One is, are the types of BMPs that we're putting out, these gravel bags and these weighted wattles, working? And then we also had multiple configurations. We had a lot of players out there, and we were really trying to figure out how best to place these to filter correctly, because gravel bags and wattles filter differently. And also wanting to make sure that we still got flood water off of the street and we didn't cause access issues or, you know, into the travel lanes. So we looked at three different configurations that we had attempted. And what we found is that each of them performed to the same order of magnitude. So all of those configurations were proving effective, which allowed us to select the one that was least impactful to our active roadways. So with those BMP, we're looking at upstream and downstream of the installed BMP in the gutter pan and doing grab samples to look at that loading. Then when we actually were doing this, just to give, again, sense of scale, we put out about 13,000 gravel bags and 3,100 weighted wattles, and then entered into a contract to do this work. Originally it was staff and volunteers. And when that removal happened to replace, and when we quantified what we pulled out that winter, was 98.5 tons of material collected by putting out those BMPs. And then we also paralleled the water board's in-stream sampling for the March rain event. We wanted to really look at this and see how had things changed now that the debris removal was complete, and see how things had shifted. So again, we did the 5 grab samples in this coffee park storm drain system. And what we saw were, again, kind of consistent constituent levels to what regional board was finding. Again, the only thing was the aluminum, which is consistent with kind of a sediment movement. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about just what we have coming up. So I'm really pleased regional board's going to be doing additional sampling in stream. We will, again, coordinate to do parallel sampling. Because the paired samples is really where we get high value in that data. So we can see what's coming through the pipe system and what that impact is, if any, to the receiving water. As you all know from the WERT studies and from the wildland fire studies, years 2 through 5 tend to be the higher loading for due to mass wasting off of hillside. Now we're a little bit different because we have an urban area as well, so we'll be interested to see how that, what we find. And then we're doing a huge effort with winter preparedness because we are now shifted into rebuild with over 1,000 active permits pulled for Coffee Park alone. We really are moving into that type of work. So I will hold these up. I put some of them out on the table out here. So we've created some outreach materials, construction site brochure just to help. And we have a lot of people working from out of the area, help people understand what BMPs they need to be doing for their construction sites. And then we also have one for homeowners. If the site is not under rebuild, it still needs some protection and needs to be cared for. Those BMPs may be out of date. And then, of course, I always like to bring our spill card so that our public can be our eyes and ears out in the world. We have 24-hour response capability, so want people to know they can call in issues if they're seeing anything but rain down the storm drain. All of these efforts, we're partnering with kind of social media campaign. We're also going to a whole slew of community block captain and other meetings in the month of September and October. I hope that that gives you a little bit of a sense of where we're at as a city, and we have this strong continued partnership with the Watershed Task Force and Regional Board, of course. Any questions?
All right. So any questions for any of the current panelists?
Questions or comments?
Go for it, John. A little bit. Be very helpful for the sediment monitoring. Mm-hmm. To give a brief sketch of the upslope. So, for example, the percent of burn, what is the slope, the soils, whether the roads are dirt or paved, and the type and density of the forest or shrubbery, mm-hmm. and whether they use water bars, water ditches, culverts to convey water. And one thing that surprises me in your studies when I've seen them on dirt roads with culverts is the debris plugs up the culverts. And that may not occur the first one, although usually it's there pretty quick. So I don't know what the maintenance program is upslope, but I'm surprised it's so little sediment. And it may just be that it's these other factors are controlling that. But that's just my overall comment is what I've seen with the stress of large acreage, high-intensity fires on slopes is dirt does move and branches do plug up. They'll plug up the ditches, the water bars, and the culverts, believe mm-hmm. it or not, just everything.
Heaven, we had an item just before lunch, which was talking about kind of the cleanup response here, you know, talking about just the physical cleanup. You know, the city of Santa Rosa surely was a partner in that as well. But, you know, it's so darn amazing to think that that happened less than a year ago. Right. And just the magnitude of that is still a bit kind of numbing and hard to get my head around. At the same time, the efforts by agencies, by contractors, by individuals, homeowners, everybody kind of involved, I just am amazed at what kind of work went on. There was a concept of luck that got introduced, that we got lucky, you know, right, that everybody got engaged and a lot of cleanup happened fast. The weather cooperated with us. You know, that's no small amount of waddles. Those things are like wrestling alligators, frankly. you know, and at the same time, you know, looking at infrastructure that was, you know, I was out on a site this week looking at it up off of Mark West, and all the culverts had melted. So they had to go in and put all new culverts in. And going through this road, there was probably a dozen of them. It was fairly significant. And, you know, I know that the challenge of Santa Rosa on the Fountain Grove water system, finding benzene in that system, which is amazingly challenging, I would imagine. I just want to compliment you. I know that there's some county folks here. There's other folks here. And I just want to spread that, you know, the compliment here of having a response, a thoughtful response, a coordinated response, given the craziness that went on. Let me ask you a couple things. So, grab samples out here. Analyte list, you know, did you guys, the one thing we did, I got to say, I'm a consultant by trade. And so, you know, we did a bunch of cleanups and, you know, we only looked for really metals, pH, asbestos, that type of thing, right? We didn't look for PCBs. We didn't look for dioxins, furans. There's some certain things we didn't look for. Mm-hmm. On the coarse grain level sampling that happened here on the initial response, and Catherine, you might be able to answer this as well. 70 constituents. I mean, you could eat up 70 constituents based on a CAM-17 list and PAHs, but how broad was that initial sampling done? I'm just curious.
We did also look for PCBs. I don't believe we did dioxins, but we tried to be comprehensive in the sense that, excuse me, I don't have the exact list in front of me, but we did look at what we would need to monitor, what might come off of a burn landscape. So we tried to focus on those
sure.
parameters versus the ones that we traditionally do and just skip those that we didn't think we needed because we probably wouldn't be seeing a signal from the fire if we were measuring them.
Yeah, and to pick almost like signature pollutants that you would expect, right? Mobilization of signature pollutants. I mean, our whole world is basically alumina silicate, so aluminum doesn't really surprise me so much, but let me ask you, Heaven. So from the standpoint, too, there was in the beginning, you know, you and I talked at one point about the city had contemplated pumping these storm drains during active storms. Did any of that, did you guys ever go that far?
We did not, and for a number of reasons. When we first shifted day three, we started asking ourselves how we were going to contain this. We hit the ground with what we had. And there was a lot of discussion about other approaches and what do we do if this isn't effective and how do we intercept that water. There was interest particularly in looking at a pilot in Coffee Park to pump and intercept and perhaps do advanced treatment on that water. What it really came down to were two things. One, that the BMPs we were putting in, the gravel bags and waddles, were being effective, which is a huge win and a huge breath of relief for our efforts. Second to that, it was a feasibility issue. That storm drain system actually receives a very large amount of almost, if I'll call it, run-on incoming water from the other side of the hill, and it's actually an underground creek at one point, so we have very large systems. So in terms of feasibility to have enough pumping capacity and enough Baker tanks, enough space to place everything, enough capacity in the sewer system to receive that water, it ended up being a very large effort for what would have been a fairly small recurrence interval that we would effectively have attempted to capture.
At the same time, Heaven, on the BMPs, you guys put out these waddles and the gravel bags and those types of things. Did those all come out because they were consumed and you're looking at now replacing them fresh coming into the new season of rain?
So we, during last winter, they were put in and then replaced and then pulled out and replaced as needed throughout the season. This winter, we are not headed in that same direction for a couple of reasons. Primarily, the sites are cleaned up and we're moving into construction. So really our focus at this point is that the parcels need to be prepared to contain themselves. And we have increased in some of our winter preparedness, some of our other efforts. So again, we have cleaned those systems. So we're completing Fountain Grove and about to start Coffee Park to clean the pipes from anything that could have gotten in over the summer. We've increased street sweeping to twice monthly instead of once a month. And we're also doing all of our pre-rain inspections to get all of the construction sites in ready to hold themselves. And so that's really where we're going now. The placement of BMPs directly in the right-of-way at this point in time, we feel wouldn't be as effective, largely because of the construction traffic. Yeah. So those BMPs, even in toward the end of our efforts last year, were often moved, run over, destroyed, or borrowed onto neighboring sites. And so it was a very big practical struggle to keep them in place where they needed to be. So for a number of reasons, what we're really looking at is other options to control pollutants this winter.
Yeah, it's almost like we have a couple thousand little construction stormwater sites at this point in time, right?
Exactly.
And I got to say, too, is I would gather or I would think that the MS4 program, which you guys have been active participant in 20 years almost, something like that,
yeah.
Has got to pay you some dividends. You've got a great background data set, although at quite a steep cost, no doubt. But at the same time, you know, you also have a well-oiled machine of MS4 and stormwater coordination within the city of Santa Rosa.
Yeah.
And again, I commend you guys. I commend the fact that you guys responded so fast, that you were so engaged, that it was daunting.
Yeah.
It was really daunting.
And I think we're working really hard right now to build those partnerships with the developers and the construction realm. We actually came this morning from the North Coast Builders Exchange and a meeting that we hold with them for the largest rebuild companies that are doing that work. So, yeah, that's really where our focus is at this point. But thank you. I really appreciate
yeah,
the support.
You bet. Kevin, can I ask you, too, did you have the same experiences in the Napa, you know, kind of upper valley stuff?
Well, we did not need to replace our wattles throughout the season. They just kind of, the urban footprint is much smaller, so a lot of these are rural areas, not even curb and gutter necessarily. So we did more effort to protect around burnt homes and structures. Also, there were much fewer number of structures destroyed and fires in our region. So that's a bit how our efforts worked. And we really were just supporting our local entities through some cleanup and abatement funds that we use to help a nonprofit go out there and work with them and with CAL FIRE. And so those structures, BMPs, really lasted for this season, more or less. And I must say, these are good questions that I'm starting to think, well, what are our, I'm on the water quality side and monitoring side, but I'm interested in and in getting some more information on from the counties and the cities to say, what are they doing to prepare for next year or this winter? But I think the answer will be a bit similar, that it's about construction, it's about just sediment, and some of those other broader concerns about sediment from the natural landscape that didn't transport all the way down the watershed yet, but it's there, and we'll probably see more of it this year if we get some really large rain events.
And Catherine, one last question for you. So is regional board, who's coordinating then kind of the regional monitor? Is it a coordinated regional response at this point, given county and city? How is this being done?
We have a really wonderful in-house team of Rich Fadness, our surface water ambient monitoring program coordinator, and Lisa Bernard, who is in the planning unit, who are the folks who did this last time with Carrie Ann Lopez, who is not with us any longer. So the two of them will be doing the initiating, the coordination, and are the ones who communicated last year and the other staff from other organizations were great at reaching out to determine timing of sampling and what everyone was sampling. And so we'll be doing that again this year.
Great. Thank you so much.
Now, while our next four presenters are coming up, so go ahead and come on up, I will introduce them. Our first speaker will be Todd Schramm. Did I say that correctly? Okay, wonderful. Who is an engineer with the Sonoma County Water Agency. We also have Lisa McKaylee, who is the president and CEO of the Pepperwood Foundation. We have Virginia Mahacek, who's with the Sonoma County Office of Recovery and Resiliency and one of the co-chairs of the Watershed Task Force. And finally, we have last but not least, we have Chuck Striplin, who's an environmental scientist here at the North Coast Regional Board.
Oh, thank you. Let's see. Okay, good afternoon, board members. My name is Todd Schramm, and I am an engineer with Sonoma County Water Agency. I've been there 12 years and work in water resource planning. When the fires hit last fall, I took on the role of the program lead for our field activities and coordinating the work in the Russian River watershed is where we focused our surface water quality monitoring program. And first, before I get into my presentation, I did want to acknowledge the support that we did receive at the start of this from the regional board. We had Carrie Ann Lopez actually come out and helped us out with the first baseline sampling that we did and really gave us some guidance and pointers on how to get started. So thank you.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Well, our monitoring program was a little different than the previous monitoring programs in that one of our main focuses here was to look at potential risk to our water production facilities, Wooler and Mirabel in Forestville. So we were concerned about changes in water quality and how that may adversely impact the treatment efficacy of riverbank filtration, which is what we rely on for clean water at Wooler and Mirabel facilities. And the Russian River is the primary water source for the water agency, for 600,000 of our customers. And as mentioned, riverbank filtration is what we rely on, and that is basically a natural process of removal of pathogens and contaminants as we pull the river water through the alluvium. And so this monitoring program was basically an extension of some long-term work that we've been doing that is assessing basically it's working on improving our understanding of how the riverbank filtration works and identify potential vulnerabilities. And so this work has been going on since 2008 and working with Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory as well as researchers at U.S. Geological Survey. And with our monitoring program, we have three components of what we're gathering here. We have surface water samples, sediment samples, and ash samples have been collected. With the surface water samples, we are collecting the aqueous samples, both filtered and unfiltered samples, and as well as looking at the microorganisms present with some analysis of the filters. When we go out and do our periodic sampling with for surface water, we also do basically a sediment grab sample at our locations. In addition to that work, we also once a year are going out and grabbing about 5 gallons of sediment, which we're characterizing and analyzing and eventually using in some column studies that are being conducted at USGS, at the research lab in Boulder, Colorado. No, that's the sediment. That's the sediment. Yeah. The ash, and yeah, one more item before the ash samples. We have cryocore samples, which is actually ongoing work that's been going on for a while now, that we do at our Wooler facility, and so that's pulling about 18 inches of the sediment and pore water, basically using liquid nitrogen to pull up basically an intact vertical profile of the sediment, and then characterizing both the sediment as well as pore water. And lastly, we have ash samples. We've collected at several sites in the area, and we'll go into that. The ash samples are part of the column studies that are being done in Boulder, Colorado.
So, Todd, you just took ash from different areas, leached them with either DI water or citric acid or whatever, and ran almost like a DI wet sample on these? Is that what you're doing?
I have a slide where we talk about the ash. I don't quite go into that detail, but
okay, that's all right.
But I can try to provide some more details on that. So as far as our sampling protocol, we basically have, we have at each site, each sampling round, we're collecting basically a single grab sample at each site. We started off shortly after the fires. October 19th was when we actually went out and collected a baseline sampling round at 10 locations, and followed that up with basically what we had called our wet season protocol. We have four post-storm events, basically, where we sampled at 11 locations in the watershed. And next slide, I think, is where we cover what locations those are. And that was where we used during the wet season was when we did the most amount of running of parameters. We found that last winter we actually encountered some dry conditions, and so to kind of fill in those storm events, we went out and scheduled it on a 2 to 3 week basis out and did some additional sampling at our Woolder and Maribel facility. And that leads us into the dry season, where for the last 4 months we've gone out on a monthly basis and collected samples at five sites, so about half as many sites, and looking at any potential changes we might see in water quality during this time. In addition to the monthly samples, we also have biweekly samples we've been conducting at Woolder and Mirabel. So this map here shows where we're actually sampling, and we have the fire perimeters for the Redwood Valley, the Pocket Fire, Tubbs, and Nuns fires. And so as far as the selection of sites, we try to capture downstream of most of these burn sites and areas that would be contributing to basically our Woolder and Mirabel production facilities. So during the wet season, there's 11 sites, three on the main stem. And let's see here if I have a pointer. Where is the pointer? Is this the pointer? Oh, there we go. Let's see. So down in the lower river, we have Woolder and Mirabel here as two sites. Going up on the, we have Jimtown and Cloverdale, as far as the three locations where the main stem sampling has been done. As far as the eight tributary sites, starting up in the top, we've got one on the West Fork at the USGS stream gauge, one at the Calpella stream gauge on the East Fork, going down the Big Sulphur Creek, that's at the bridge there. Right before the confluence with the Russian. Down here, Franz Creek. Initially with the baseline, there was no flow in Franz Creek, and we did a sample over in Makama Creek. But once we got flow, then we shifted everything to Franz Creek because we noticed that there was a lot more burn area upstream of Franz Creek than there was the other location. Moving on down the Tubbs Fire area, we have Mark West Creek, and that's at the Fulton Road. Brush Creek, which is, I think, the West Fork of the Brush Creek, I think also called Rincon Creek over here. And lastly, Matanzas Creek over, I think that's Beth Arbs in that region of Santa Rosa. So, as I mentioned, in the dry season, we have a more limited number of sites that we're going out to. The East Fork, basically downstream of Lake Mendocino, right at the Coyote Valley Dam, is a new site that we're doing during the dry season to capture basically Lake Mendocino releases to see if there's any water quality changes from the dam. In addition to that, we do have Dry Creek. Dry Creek is actually part of the wet season and dry season. It is our control site or reference site. It's basically outside of any of the burned areas. And one site that's missing here for the dry season is the Gemtown over here, which we are continuing to do through the dry season, and then we'll learn Mirabelle as well. So as far as what we're actually sampling for, we've got a suite of things, and it does vary. We have year-round parameters that we're sampling for, dissolved organic carbon, anions, cations, total dissolved nitrogen, iron and mercury we're doing basically dissolved and whole water analyses for. And in addition to that, we also are doing some DNA work as far as trying to characterize the biofilms on the sediments that are collected. In addition, in the wintertime, we're actually running ICP-MS and doing a trace metal analysis. And the PFAS is actually the perfluoral alkyl substances. That's a potential ingredient to flame retardant, so we're looking for that as an indicator of potential use of that in fighting some of the wildfires. And the last item is sugars, and that's an analysis that's a little side research project of anhydrous sugars. There's one researcher that's at the USGS that's looking into the use of particular sugars as an indicator of burn runoff. So there's certain sugars that are generated in certain temperature forest fires. So as far as our sediment sampling, we're mostly looking at the biofilms and looking at to capture biofilms and then grow them in the lab for some column study work. We also are analyzing those samples for carbon, nitrogen, and mercury. As far as our ash collection efforts, we have, thanks to the Pepperwood Foundation, who gave us access to their properties on several occasions, as well as the Open Space District and regional parks. So initially, the approach that we took, we went out and did some just basically bulk sample grabs of ash at the various locations. We switched kind of midway through and went with a random sampling gathering approach. And the picture in the center is a diagram of kind of the approach that we're using there, which is the random sampling grid that's developed. Actually, it's an Excel spreadsheet that we use to basically plot out where we actually take sample cores from in the ash zone that we have identified. This shows it as it's a circular area of 15 meter radius, and all those dots represent cores that we then eventually measured out from a single point at the ash site to collect cores from. And as far as our ash collection efforts, this is going into basically ash characterization of the leachate generated, what kind of constituents are coming out of the ash. And then that is actually being used for some column studies that are being done by USGS. And the goal there is to look at how changes in water quality would affect biofilm growth and various biological chemical processes that we rely on for treatment at the Wilder Mirabelle sites. Now with our analytical results, our monitoring program is geared towards more of research. So we're looking at, impacts from the fires last fall, but also we have, future fires that we're planning for. So we're not on a quick turnaround time with our results, but we do have approved data from the USGS who's coordinating all of the sampling analysis, the analytical work that's being done, up through about, that chart's a little outdated, but I think through February we have approved data, which is now being made available on the USGS website called ScienceBase. And currently that's you need to request access to that, but it is being made available And that would be just the raw data. And so the work that we're doing now with the analytical results and ongoing is taking that raw data and doing some analysis and interpretation of what that means. We do have some control sites, and we have our baseline sampling of pre-runoff, but we're in the process of kind of pulling together information, because these are a lot of these tributary sites are other new sites for us, and we don't have these type of parameters that we're sampling for as a reference. So that's the process we're looking at, because we do see elevations, as some of these plots show, in phosphorus and DOC and dissolved nitrogen, but whether or not that's typical in a given winter season, or whether there's an elevation due to the wildfires is what we're trying to assess. As far as the next steps, our plan is actually to continue sampling through next year. We have basically been looking at recently the Mendocino Complex fire, and there's about 25,000 acres that have burned in the Russian River watershed. So we did recently just an assessment of kind of where our sampling points are, and it looks like as far as the Ranch fire, Calpella, our Calpella sampling site is actually a good location for capturing all of that, all of those burned areas associated with that fire. We are, as far as the river fire, we are looking at establishing a new site for this season, which is most likely going to be in Hopland at the Hopland USGS stream gauge. So as far as additional kind of long-term planning for wildfires, we're looking at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab is working on the development of a flow and reactive transport model, which would be a watershed model to help us assess, based on burn areas and locations, what the potential water quality changes might be. So that would be a tool that we'll be developing over the next year or so. And lastly, we have the continuation of the ash leachate studies. We've started a few of those. They tend to go for a while, months at a time. So we're still working through those.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, thank you for having me today. My name is Lisa McKaylee. I'm the president of the Pepperwood Foundation, and I'm really pleased to talk to you today about a very successful collaboration with the Water Agency and USGS focused on looking at the fire's impacts on soil runoff and sedimentation. And if you're not familiar with Pepperwood, we're a nonprofit science institute and field station in the Marquess watershed. We drain into a couple other lower Russian River watersheds. That's our center, the Dwight Center for Conservation Science, which actually survived the fire incredibly well. It's a concrete cement building built into the ground. But we were hit early on by the Tubbs fire with some pretty high intensity burns on site. That shows the extent of the preserve that was burned. The two western extents were stopped by CAL FIRE. The center little green patch was our prescribed burn from last year, where our cows hung out and survived. But we're in the Mayacamas between Calistoga and Santa Rosa. And one of the values of inviting all these different researchers to come to our site is that we have 5 years of baseline data, pre-fire conditions, so we can really look at the watershed response over time. So we joined all of our colleagues in trying to take advantage of this event to collect empirical field data, because the watershed emergency response team reports that came out, largely the runoff and debris flow estimates are based on Southern California data. So the state's well aware that they need data in this area to better refine those models. This is showing you sample sites in terms of runoff and sedimentation on the preserve up at the upper left, and then through the rest of the burn site. In addition to the work I'm describing today, we're working with the Water Agency to augment the density of rain gauges, stream gauges. We have a stormwater system that we're also hosting equipment for. So the key questions that we're approaching via the study is, number one, how severely were the soils impacted by the fire? Number two, how long is it going to take the watersheds to return to their pre-fire conditions? And how does this vary with other factors that impact infiltration in particular? And then what are the rainfall thresholds for processes that transport sediment? And what are the expected sediment fluxes to streams? The little graph I'm showing is an infiltration plot. It's infiltration over time in terms of how fast a column of water is sinking in to the earth. And it's showing the different curves by geology type at Pepperwood. So the higher the curve and the steeper the curve, the more infiltration that we're seeing. And I'm a hydrologist by training, but I've never worked in a fire environment. It's interesting. I think people think of hydrophobicity as a very superficial event where you basically burn and get the soils glassy. But it's really a different kind of process that can intensify over the wet season. And this chart is showing you that the A horizon, which is sort of granular material and ash and fried soils, it's really the B horizon where that hydrophobicity forms, and it's from the finer particles getting in there and clogging the pores of the soil. And so at our site, you can see a similar thing, probably better without the lights, but an A horizon, a very coarse material, and then this B horizon where darker, finer material is accumulating over the parent material. And this is just showing you one of our infiltration sites where we're taking a soil sample because we need to calibrate all of these, and the infiltrometer, which I'll describe in a second. And this is literally a tube that you stick on the ground. It's in suction contact, and there's a vacuum in there, and very patient technicians sit and watch the water drop. But it is the most meaningful physical measurement of how fast the water is going to sink in, and in turn, what the runoff might look like. Just to show the sampling strategy that the GS team came up with the water agency, we're sampling the different primary geologies in the area and adding the different vegetation cover. And I will say we're really in the process of analyzing this work, and we're going to continue it for the next year or two, but I can show you some preliminary results. And just an idea of this is in December when we first had the folks out about the patchiness of the effect that we're looking at. And you can see the relative patchiness of different burn intensities on the site. But the way that we're going to track the recovery of the soil over time is to keep coming out every month. I have a 9-month-old nephew who has to go to tummy time classes, and I call this tummy time for grown-up geologists, where they're sitting there watching it drop. And this is just an example at one of our sites. That December 2017 curve actually had higher infiltration than when they came back and looked in February. And that's an effect, again, of the soil sealing effect subsurface. However, we're very aware that where there's a lot of cracking in the soils, either due to the fire or gopher holes, et cetera, you get these big openings that can counteract that effect. So we've got pretty diverse results that will help inform the different mechanisms we're looking at. And this is just a time series. Again, just think that the higher you are in the curve, the more infiltration there is, where you see there's been a dip into the spring, but we're starting to see recovery during the dry season at a whole bunch of different sites, different geology and veg cover. So the second part of this project is looking at mapping the different geomorphic surfaces in the burn areas, and then quantifying the amount of sediment we can find in the field coming off of those, and then scaling that up to the whole mapped area. And we're really lucky to have some wonderful geomorphologists doing this map for us, the GS. And this is the stuff I love. They're actually going out and measuring the volume of the sediment accumulating at the bottom of the hill. And they can tell what's generated by the fire by whether or not there's a high carbon and charcoal influence. So they can determine that. So this is looking at a road cut, but we're also going to look at stream cuts. And where possible, we're going to test the utility of LIDAR to also see if it can come up with some of these deposits. And then when we combine those field results with the geomorphic map, we can start to generate an estimate per each kind of soil delivery mechanism, what the total load might look like. And that would be taking then the area of all those different units and multiplying it by the sediment yield that we measure in the field. So I always have to encourage people to come visit Pepperwood. If you want to come visit us, come on up. But in addition to our field station role, we're really out there actively managing the landscape and implementing forest thinning and other fire resilience methods, including prescribed burning. And we'll be able to look at these results in the context of management moving forward. Thanks.
forward button is well worn. Good afternoon. Oh, let's see, how we do this one. Am I on? Perfect. Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Noren and Board. My name is Virginia Mohacek. You can leave the lights up. My slides are not very pretty. Thanks. I appreciate the chance to speak with you today. For all of my professional career, I've been a consulting fluvial geomorphologist, and only post-fire in mid-March, I took on a job as county staff in the new recovery resiliency team of the county administrator's office. And my primary role in that position is as the natural resources strategy lead for the recovery and resilience planning efforts. But I also have a responsibility as the county's watershed coordinator, and in that role, I inherited co-leadership of the Watershed Task Force, along with Rita Miller of the city. She was going to try and make it today. I don't know if she's here. Looks like no. The Watershed Task Force kind of history and origin during and after the fires, obviously I've read and learned from the archives and the anecdotes. It did arise pretty spontaneously and had participation from numerous local groups, governments, the counties of both Sonoma and Napa, multiple cities, and then a whole bunch of different county family entities, both from the natural resource side and from public health and safety side. And then there were participation, as you have heard others speak about, from some of the NGOs and interested parties that were obviously learning about and experiencing the fact that large percentages of the watersheds were burning and, you know, extensive stream reaches were potentially affected directly and then subsequently could be indirectly affected. And I do want to give special credit. My understanding is that CAL FIRE's incident team really came in and provided organizational structure and guidance to really set kind of the watershed task force function. And then the regional boards, both of whom are represented today in the room, really have played a great role. They continue to be pivotal in providing technical guidance, kind of moral support related to prioritization and strategies, as well as having leadership in some of the field efforts, and then as we'll talk more with Chuck about where we go next with some of the monitoring. I will point out that during late 2017 and 2018, clearly the focus of the Watershed Task Force activities was on protecting the natural environment, especially water bodies, waterways, and water quality. And that started with those efforts that, as Heaven mentioned, were during and immediately following the active fire, even while fires were still burning, where people were mobilizing to put containment out to prevent fire debris and ash and other contaminants from getting into the water systems. There was quite a bit of coordination involved, and the public entities were responding in the areas of their responsibility. And then there was a big effort to find ways to integrate the efforts of the volunteers, the NGOs, and other nonprofits to participate in and be part of the response on private lands in particular. And then I think as Region 2 mentioned, there were contracts with NGOs to help protect some of the riparian corridors. The other activity that was really dominant during the winter, whoops, I should let you guys at least see that, was improving the forecasting ability as they anticipated winter activities, and that was both improving the network about weather, rainfall, and runoff situations, taking a lot of integrated information and creating a more accessible dashboard that also is publicly accessible and continues now and is going to continue to be used at SonomaOneRain.com. And the Water Agency led that particular effort, although a lot of people have participated in that and continue to do so. There was changes going on also to warning and alert systems for the runoff events, for water stage changes, and that was handled in coordination with the fire and emergency services as well. During the winter storms or potential winter storms, the storm patrol efforts were also kind of routed through the Watershed Task Force to be a hub of figuring out how to kind of streamline the geography of patrolling and responding. And we expect to be doing some kind of similar coordination again this year. And then you've heard a lot from all the previous presenters about the post-fire monitoring that's gone on, and the Watershed Task Force was meeting regularly and providing a way for folks from all these different entities to communicate about their plans and coordinate the timing and the nature of their programs within their different financial and resource constraints and try and make them match the purposes and goals of those programs as best as possible. So right now, we're leading into winter two, and we did get pretty fortunate with a gentle winter last year. And as we know from research and from empirical evidence and experience of some of the players, years two to five can actually still be fairly risky depending upon severity, topography, the nature of your soils, the degree of recovery, the nature of that recovery of the systems. So the Watershed Task Force mission and role is still important. We're trying really hard to make sure we make improvements to both public and agency awareness about potential secondary hazards that can be happening in this coming winter or two. And, you know, we're doing that very mindful of a lot of the primary priorities for both survivors and the community is the personal resources that folks need to get back in homes, to make their own emotional and mental recovery, and that this is definitely important, but it needs to be kind of nested within that bigger context, too, of community recovery. So we're trying to get the message out that there's both obligation and responsibility to be aware of the kind of vulnerabilities that sites may have during the coming winter. And we're trying to help them understand that it's a combination of hydrology changes, soil changes, vegetation changes that can modify both runoff volumes, peak flow rates, provide differences in pulses, and then the location of where sediment might be moving off the slope system and then into the stream systems. So that's going to have both a water quality potential impact and then a true channel stability, bank erosion, land loss, or possible aquatic habitat implications. So we're trying to get information circulating that people realize why it matters to be doing some continued monitoring both in the water column of the channels and up on the slopes. We feel that the Watershed Task Force has been really successful working with each other, and we're trying to build on that success and collaborate about how to prioritize the things we work on as a task force, the things we kind of hand off to individual entities, and the things we may be handing off to regional monitoring, which we'll talk about. So right now we're really focusing on the burn zones and a few of those downstream potential response reaches or sensitive reaches, and then working on ways that we could improve how information can come in to public entities. So the city's My Santa Rosa web and app-based online tool, the SoCo Report It web and mobile app reporting tool, we're in the process of making some adjustments to allow for some of the stormwater issues and some of the types of things that people might observe in post-fire landscape, that those can be reported and then routed real efficiently to the right kind of either public entity or partner for response. And I do know folks from the Permit Sonoma and folks from the city have been talking during Watershed Task Force meetings and often spending a lot of time outside of that to improve the collaboration between the co-permittees on ways to communicate with the rebuild areas and then the other zones, especially of the burned areas that are particularly, you know, vulnerable, and we're trying to work with the fact that the landscape's vulnerable. The landowners are also in a state that still need to be really communicated with effectively so that they can prioritize carrying out the protections they need to do. So we're trying to be ready, and we're doing some mailings that are going out this coming week to kind of remind people to gather the information. Both the city and the county have generated some new pamphlets that'll be hard copy resources and online online postings via the continued joint SonomaCountyRecovers.org website. So that's kind of where we're at right now.
Thank you, Virginia.
Mm-hmm. Good afternoon, Chairman Noren. Members of the board, my name is Chuck Striplin. I'm an environmental scientist of your staff in the Watershed Adaptive Management Unit. As Catherine indicated, I'm going to get into a few items related to our work in the area of post-fire long-term planning and monitoring. I wanted to thank my fellow panelists. As you can see, there's just been a tremendous flurry of activity by a great number of our partners focused on the near-term recovery of our watersheds, both in terms of public lands, but also in providing as much assistance as possible to a great many private landowners and businesses affected by the fires. Between the regional board and our partner agencies in the watershed, we feel like we have a pretty good handle on monitoring fire-related impacts to water quality in the near term. Our ability to predict major rain events is increasing significantly due to the efforts of Sonoma Water and their partners. And through the capacities developed or expanded because of the fires, such as those described by my fellow panelists, we now have good channels of communication with our partners and effective mechanisms for communication and collaboration around fire-related projects and initiatives. Many of these efforts are focused on preventing further impairment of our waterways and aquatic resources this coming winter. But at the same time, especially given a second year of major fires in and around the region, there's a collective acknowledgement of the need for a framework to coordinate basin-wide monitoring activities such that we are better able to monitor and protect watershed health on a longer-term basis. In this context, it's often useful to take in a larger view and consider issues of scale, cost, organizational capacities, technical approaches, partnerships, management questions, and risk. What's shown here are the perimeters of large-scale fire events over the last 60 to 70 years. Looking back just in this time period, we can see that large fires impact our watersheds differently in different decades, and they tend to occur in more inland areas. But these kind of data sets point to a lot of questions. Will these patterns change? What could or should we be doing to prepare for larger fires in other portions of the watershed, both in terms of prevention, but also in terms of monitoring and mitigating their impacts? As a region of partners, we're doing a lot. All of these interagency efforts, among others, have been either initiated or expanded in response to the fires. And their missions range from forest and fuels management to basin-wide water quality monitoring to source water protection. Specific to monitoring water quality, this board has been briefed previously on a range of efforts by this office and our partners to both detect acute discharges immediately after the fires, as well as our efforts to develop a strategy for longer-term watershed health monitoring. For the balance of this presentation, I'd like to update you on the progress of the Russian River Regional Monitoring Program. The board has supported the development of this program as an effort to coordinate the monitoring of water chemistry and other parameters of watershed health at the basin scale for more than 2 years. Since the fires, the need for this capacity and coordination has never been more evident. To date, significant progress has been made toward establishing the governance framework for this program, including the formation of a steering committee consisting of executive staff from most of the resource managing agencies in the basin. A governance structure has been developed, which defines the roles and responsibilities of a steering committee, a technical advisory committee, technical work groups, and an implementation lead. I refer you to the article in the on the R3MP in your executive officer's report for a full list of current steering committee member organizations. A crucial role of the steering committee is the development of management questions. These questions establish the direction of the program as a whole and provides an organizational and technical framework which will guide the programs and the program operations and priorities. What is the ambient water quality of the Russian River watershed, and is it meeting objectives and supportive of beneficial uses? Or what are the trends in water quality in the Russian River? Or are existing permit programs effectively supporting beneficial uses? Questions like these will both guide and constrain the objective scientific information program participants are asked to provide. This approach provides for monitoring of baseline status and trends in water quality, compliance-related monitoring, as well as a framework for identifying gaps in information and the capacity to engage in special studies to answer targeted questions as conditions warrant special attention to specific issues. As one might expect, among the scores of management questions initially developed by the steering committee, there are a variety of questions related to the fires. It's been suggested by a number of steering committee members that an early potential effort by this program might be the formation of a technical working group dedicated to post-fire monitoring. As these discussions evolve, the region has secured an allocation of discretionary funds to pursue this idea and continue to develop the associated data management and visualization tools. As the work of the steering committee continues with additional meetings through early 2019, we will finalize the management questions, finalize and adopt an organizational charter, develop short and long-term funding models for the program, and coordinate with our partner agencies to advance the work of a long-term post-fire monitoring effort for the Russian River watershed. And we can entertain questions from the entire panel at this point, I think.
Great. Thank you so much. Questions? Yes. I want to, for one, just say that out of all this craziness, there obviously has been some good that's coming out of this, right? From the standpoint of the data set that come out of this, the cooperation, the professionalism, the heroics and everything else. I mean, just this kind of work and these outcomes, I think, will pay dividends in so many different ways. And we have the opportunity here, whether we come at it from a water quality standpoint, a fire resiliency standpoint, climate change, infrastructure, I think this all pays dividends. And I think, you know, we're all part of this process. A couple individual questions. Can I ask you, Virginia, from the standpoint of geomorphology and fluvial geomorphology, is the expectation this year that and the subsequent years that we'll lose root strength in burned trees and there's the chance to see more mobilization and landslope failures at this point?
Yeah, I think, well, It really depends on kind of how the soils behave, and it's true that depending upon the age and the species of the tree, what the decay rate is going to be and what kind of soil moisture conditions it's in.
Sure.
But it is true that over time, the dead standings, as the root structures decay away, the initial benefit of having them kind of still there occupying space and goes away, and the living root benefits of cohesion are gone. And so on stream banks in particular, or steeper slopes, that would become a factor because the remaining dead standing is a load on the slope and the benefit part is no longer functioning. That may take a few years, and that's kind of individual and spotty kind of occurrence. So if you think of that potential risk going up, it's happening over the same time frame that the initial hydrologic response is going to start decreasing. So probably in the short term, the hydrologic change and the specific soils and how they're reacting is a driver. And then as you start to get veg regrowth, you're going to get shallow soil reinforcement, but some of the deeper tree-related reinforcement of soils you can start to lose later. But by that time, some of the other slope system benefits, you know, are starting to come back. Stream banks a little bit different, because that can still be a problem. And so that's...
Yeah, I'd like to talk to the czar of large wood because, you know, we're driving up through, you know, Mark West and Porter Creek these days, there's a lot of big wood on the edge of the road these days. And recruitment of wood into that system, especially with the impacts to riparian trees, is pretty significant. And I just wonder, and Chuck, you may know this, is there any contemplation about using or supplanting large wood into that system from this? Do you know? Virginia?
I can answer. There actually is an active ad hoc group that is pursuing getting a long-term framework set up for, a couple of the people are here in the room today, combination of folks from NOAA Fisheries, folks from DFW, folks from water boards, folks from TPW, to see if over time, as the different burned trees tend to be removed, how can we match that up with needs for trees in restoration projects regionally. So we are, in fact, you know, moving along on that, although the very first release of a RFP for bids for has tree removals, we didn't go there because it's the urgent safety ones and trying to keep that streamlined. But there is a group working on this for the long term because there will be many years of these type of tree resources being available.
Yeah, definitely. Yep.
And the second thing is that we're pursuing some academic research and getting connections that's not really well thought through yet, but using our region and maybe pairing with other locations in the Northwest to look at how these catastrophic wildfires may be changing
through a threshold or just a pulse, sediment and large wood delivery into river systems that could affect infrastructure rebuild design parameters, or scour analyses, or expectations for stability. And that's a big deal. And, you know, we may have a local laboratory that shows us perhaps a burned and an as yet unburned example. So there's some different staff are communicating with some of our academic partners to see if we can't flesh out some research ideas. I don't know if anyone else on the team has worked on that yet.
Lisa, may I ask you, I was up by Pepperwood this last week, and I was impressed by the grass and forbs were looking great. You couldn't even tell that there was a fire. I was so blown away that the grass, you know, I was out on Cresta Road and kind of right up in that corridor, and the trees, some of those trees are really sad, but the grass and the, and some of the brush in there had really recovered fast from, and really Pepperwood, I've been to Pepperwood before. It's a lovely facility.
Great.
It's wonderful. From that standpoint, is it any different? Was this fire really any different from a wildland standpoint than say the Hanley fire or prehistoric fires to that system? It's a fire, ecology out there.
Yeah. Well, when we bring visitors out, we talk about how there were sort of two fires, and the portion of the preserve that burnt in the very first night that is the closest to Mark West Road, where the fire was just raging and so hot. That fire caused tree mortality on a small portion of the preserve. Mm-hmm. But the remainder of the preserve that took over 10 days to actually burn the whole area was a more slow ground-based fire. And from an ecological point of view, there's a lot of benefits to that. And it cleared out a lot of the understory. And you don't see very much tree mortality of the adult trees. So it's really sort of almost like two different fires. So the Hanley fire took about 4 days to cover the same territory that this fire covered in a few hours. And we do feel like it was essentially a very different kind of fire. I think my hypothesis is that the fact that we had a drought for so long may have, made that more intense, but that still remains to be tested. And then, of course, the other thing was that there had been so much more development in the watershed that there was more property and more lives at risk. Made it a different fire.
Was it really about intensity out there? Is that what you're saying? Because I out in Bennett Valley, I noticed my dad lives in Bennett Valley, and he was evacuated. I noticed that a lot of that was understory. It moved mm-hmm. fast. It burned under the oaks. The oaks looked fairly well.
The oaks are very, very resilient.
Yeah.
So there's very few places we see oak mortality. We're seeing primarily Doug fir mortality, and then of course the chaparral getting burned way back. But it loves it, and it's already coming back. It's going to be chest high probably next season. But your observation about the grasses, they actually took off, and I had to be convinced that we needed our cattle back this year. And I'm really glad I got convinced, because it was actually a boom year, because all the thatch was removed, and then there was a big dose of fertilizer put on. I will also say that we just had a fire followers meeting with all the different botanists who've been out in the preserve. There's also a big explosion of some invasive species.
Oh, interesting.
That are taking advantage of it. So we're back to, there's a good side and a bad side to it, ecologically
speaking. Well, some of that fire ecology is dependent upon fire to seed, right? Some of those trees require fire to seed.
Mm-hmm.
I believe redbuds that way. Some of those plants need that to actually.
Particularly in the chaparral
yeah.
area, but there are a lot of different, very special plants that their seeds hang out. Whatever, for the last 53 years, as long as they've been alive, they've been just chilling as a seed, and this is their chance. And there's big blooms of a lot of bulbs and iris and native. Wildflowers, the lantern and the whispering bells were seen, but they're kind of mysterious where they popped up and where they didn't pop up. So that's part of what the rare plant specialists are looking at right now.
Well, and Pepperwood seems like the perfect laboratory to go check all that out.
It is now. Well, yeah, and we have both. It's a lot of things. We're very busy. What can I say? But the other thing we're trying to do is see what the efficacy of the treatments was. Unfortunately, we don't have as many sites as we'd like to make a really meaningful comparison, but at least anecdotally, where we'd been doing thinning, how is it working? And we were also pre-fire very interested in the hydrologic effects of some of these forest treatments in terms of drought resilience as well, because having thousands of saplings that aren't being cleared out by regular fire means that you have a higher uptake from the soil. So those are all the kinds of questions. We have a great team of scientists that are using the preserve as a lab right now to work on those.
Can I ask you a global question here? So the wort was the beginning of kind of, the assessment here. Is there the plan then to, wort is a standalone document in and of itself, the outcome of this with published documentation or reports. Sounds like Sonoma, the whole Sonoma Recovery has a publication of documentation that comes out of it. Water Agency, you're a public agency as well, Todd, I know. Is there a plan to update or do a coordinated update to this? Because there's so much information now that's going to be generated from this. Chuck, can you kind of illuminate that? Does that come?
An update to the WERT report?
Well, the WERT report was the beginning of the assessment of hey, these are the potential. This is the problem, right? That and the WERT report seems like a great place to start. But I think the comment was made that the WERT report made some assumptions that may not, in fact, pan out to be correct. And that's my words on that. But from the standpoint, is there an expectation then that, say, like through the Russian River Monitoring Program or through, I'll call it PRMD because I just can't help myself, that information comes out in a coordinated way on this, given that there's been this coordination, so much information is going to come out here.
Yeah, the WERT report is an interesting animal unto itself. There's the phase one, which took place. There's a potential phase two, which typically depends on the amount of time between the control of the fires and the onset of the first rains. That we had too short of a window, really, for that to take place. I don't know that there's necessarily a coordinated formal effort to update specifically the elements of the WERT report. But in terms of some of the most important things that came out of the WERT report, which were like the values at risk, the VAR sites, we do have all of that data, and those will be part of our continued long-term monitoring framework as it develops through a work group, hopefully of the R3MP. You want to say stuff about the counties?
I wish I could say that there was the ability to offer a coordinated reporting. Right now, that would be an unfunded dream, I think. There's been great collaboration and people using their various program resources and human resources to accomplish a lot. And it's one reason I use some of the words like ad hoc efforts, because they're kind of outside of the mainstream of people's assignments, and yet they're recognized as pretty critical steps. So it'd be good to discuss further, you know, the benefits of that and how to fund some of that effort.
I'll just add that our team, we specifically recruited the people at the USGS who do the models used in the WERT report. So in terms of the science side, coordinating with CAL FIRE and making sure we're working with the people that are their sort of modelers of record and getting the US, I mean, once the USGS has an improved model, we're working with the natural hazards group so that will ideally be incorporated. So we are trying to get that information to the people who provide the statewide and nationwide modeling. So I don't know if we'll update that particular report, but the whole goal is to get the team of CAL FIRE and the state and the federal scientists that information so they can utilize it for models moving forward, at least for projections.
Yeah, that's a great goal. I mean, you know, the first thing, you know, looking at this, you know, there's the benefit that there's the unfortunate benefit, I should say, that the fires that have happened here, whether it be Lake County and the Jerusalem and Valley Fire Complex or these or the ones that are going now, is that this seems to be something that we've experienced in such an intense way in the state of California, and that we, you know, we have the ability, I think, to look and learn at some of this. Of course, there's dynamics that are situational, that they're specific to the place and time or geology or aspect or whatever that is, you know, but there certainly is so much information here that could be really useful. I imagine there's just tons of PhD and master's theses that are going to be done on this for a long, long time.
Well, I just want to thank everyone on the panel because being not a government entity, seeing how well the government worked together, and then that they actually took the effort to invite in the nonprofit and private sector was really powerful to me. And I think, you know, if anyone can figure out how to do this, we're kind of figuring it out. But it's been a great collaboration. And, you know, I mean, with the Water Agency, there were so many things we had in the pipeline that honestly, the silver lining of this event is it gave us a major lift to kind of realize a lot of things we've been talking about, adding equipment and getting it into directly into their data systems. And now that's going to be happening. So there's a silver lining there.
Yeah, and again, I think, you know, I think the silver lining here is that out of this catastrophe, out of this whole wildfire complex that's happened into this community, there are some very good things that have come out of this. And I think you and your previous panel and everybody that participated in this whole thing is testament to that. That what came out of that, the responses, the information, the things yet to come that we haven't even dreamed of yet. I think that's the opportunity that we look at now. It's certainly interesting from a water quality standpoint, you know, from Catherine, you talked about earlier about some of the sampling that was done. I mean, it's amazing that we don't see a fire signature really in water at this point. We'll see what happens as we go forward. But
yeah,
it's quite interesting.
We didn't get much rain last year.
I know. We got really super lucky, right?
Thank heavens. That was the first time I was happy about having a drought.
Any other questions? I don't have any speaker cards for this item, so I think it's just us talking. I want to thank everybody that presented here today.
I think both Chuck and I think we're going to make comments about the work.
Go ahead.
I would say that a couple of folks on the Watershed Task Force, when I said I was going to come here today and give a little story, they said maybe bring up or request that the board, working with the state board and other state agencies, think about how the decision-making on WERT focus could be maybe modified to default to include some of the natural system elements instead of that being a decision that has to be made kind of in the heat of the events, because the life safety infrastructure part is always a priority, and it's kind of optional how far the work goes, but that decision has to be made in a very constrained environment. So it seemed like a thing that would be important policy ask and see what progress could be made.
It never hurts to ask.
That's right.
I just wanted to mention, too, one of the, I guess, peripheral benefits of having survived events like this is the opportunity to evolve culture and to further penetrate the community with a higher level understanding about the role of fire in California's ecosystems. The awareness that this wasn't the first time, it was actually the fourth time since the 1870s that this particular area has burned, and that actually represents kind of a new kind of post-colonial fire regime. And the reliance on private landowners in this watershed because of the ubiquity of private land tenure here, just as an example, the Sonoma County Water Agency has started a Fire Smarts Lake Sonoma program that's really engaged with the landowners, the Army Corps of Engineers, the Water Agency. I attended a meeting last week. And to a person, every single landowner in that watershed, at least the ones that attended, which were some of the largest, including the Cooleys, they were deeply invested in becoming personally involved in managing vegetation managing fuels on their properties. And that's a shift that I've seen over the last decade or so. That's only exacerbated by surviving events like this.
Yeah, I just read an article yesterday, Chuck, about Mount Tam Mill Valley is really looking hard about what they're going to do, because they are really, really one of the higher risks in fire danger in an urban wildland interface that's been built into, that has many of the same characters of what were, say, like Fountain Grove up in that area. And people definitely do a lot of things up there. But I think, as you say, you know, it's brought together some changes in behavior or thinking and participation that, you know, kind of we're all in this together. I'm thankful, by the way, that all you are involved in this, that we have agencies, individuals, NGOs, everybody here that is, again, the outcome of this is very good. We just had to go through a horrible thing to get here. And I think to magnify the positive here is a really kind of special thing to be able to look at it from this point in time. Less than 1 year out, there's been so much done, and there's yet a lot to do. So please let us know how it goes, one way or another, how we can help. We'll make the ask at the state board. We're going to the state board next month, so I'm going to ask.
Ooh,
right on.
You.
Thank you so much for coming. We're going to take a 10-minute break, and then we're going to come back and take this exciting update on cyanobacteria harmful algal blooms monitoring and response program from Mr.